From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Sometimes it isn't just a game.
There's a joy to this game, is there not?
Yes, sir.
This is a game we are gonna win. This is the game that people are gonna talk about for years to come.
We look at the psychology behind our love for sports this hour, and we'll get a postcard from Atlanta's Pride Parade. We'll say goodbye to the Macon Symphony and add a couple more tunes to our essential Georgia playlist. But first, if you haven't already, take just a couple minutes out of your day to support this show. If you listen every day, if you listen most days, then it's probably worth your support. We're in the middle of our fall fun drive. Just go to gpb.org and click donate or call 800-222-4788. Dear Martin is a new novel by Atlanta author Nick Stone. It explores police violence against people of color, among a number of other things. It's all through the eyes of a teenage boy and the letters that he writes to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The book comes out today, and it launches with an event tonight at the National Center for Human and Civil Rights in Atlanta. Author Nick Stone joins me now. Hello there.
Hi, Celeste. It's nice to be here.
You want... This is going to be a spoiler-free interview, but I think we can start at the very beginning, at the very opening. The lead character of your novel is handcuffed and nearly arrested for trying to help out one of his friends who's drunk, and it just shapes the whole rest of the book. That's when he begins writing these letters to Dr. Martin Luther King. Why start there?
I once heard somebody say that you should always open a story with a bang of action, like, and then the shot went off. You know, you want to open your story in a way that's going to grip your reader. And really, I started there because that's the catalyst for this drastic change in his worldview. He's trying to help this girl get home, and he is, you know, he's got a hoodie on, and there are things about his appearance that make this police officer...
He's got a hoodie from his prep school,
from his prep school, exactly.
And he's wearing headphones.
Yeah. And there are things about him, though, that make this officer suspicious, and I think would make a lot of people suspicious. But that's why I started the novel that way, because I want people to see that, like, just because a person looks a certain way doesn't necessarily mean that they're up to no good.
You know, we'll talk a little bit about some of the themes that are in there, but you must have heard the news that one school has taken To Kill a Mockingbird out of its curriculum because it makes students uncomfortable. And the whole time I was reading your novel, I was like, this makes me uncomfortable. What are your thoughts on books that discomfort people?
They're important. I mean, I feel like books that make people uncomfortable are the most important books, because if you're always comfortable, nothing about the way you think will ever change. To Kill a Mockingbird, I love To Kill a Mockingbird. It is an interesting book in the way that it examines racism. And I think that there are books that should be taught kind of with it, so you have both sides.
Context.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. This book is written to make people uncomfortable. Like, if you're not uncomfortable reading it...
Mission accomplished. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. If you're not uncomfortable reading it, then I did something wrong.
Right. And as we go into Halloween, and we're about to see a whole bunch of costumes that are very inappropriate, we can talk about the Halloween incident in the book in which he and a bunch of friends, mostly white, decide to make a protest, I guess, by dressing as stereotypes. And one of the stereotypes is a KKK. He dresses in a full KKK costume. And I kept thinking, wow, this is advanced. This is advanced for young readers. How did you feel about what material, what questions to answer for your readers and what questions to leave unanswered?
I honestly feel like most questions are left unanswered. And if you think about what is on television and what kids have access to just with iPads, like, you go to YouTube, you can see just about anything. So I feel like it's not necessarily, I don't think it's too advanced. The idea for this Halloween statement, I'll put it like that, comes from a character in the novel who believes in this like idea of a post-racial society. So
white kid,
yeah,
very
he's a white, very
kid.
Entitled, and his idea is to set out like he wants to set out to prove that things are equal. So we're all going to go out together in these costumes where we're dressed to stereotypes, so that people will see that people who are different can all be together. And the whole thing kind of blows up in his face, as
pretty
one
much
would
immediately.
Expect. Yeah, I think, and you know, and I think that it's an important scene, because there's this notion of colorblindness and this idea of like a post-racial society, when at the same time you have police violence, you have people of African American descent being, you know, stopped and frisked and shot, and you know, there are people of color still suffering. So clearly we have a problem, you know?
So let's go back to that and actually hear from a real life instance of this. Jordan Davis was a black teenager. He was shot and killed by a white man because his music was too loud at a gas station. That was over, it was in 2012. We actually spoke with Jordan Davis's mother last year. So here is a comment from Lucie McBath.
I think this is an awakening in the country that is going to cause us as a nation to look at just who we are and what we think about our fellow man, and how much value do you place on the lives of people that don't look, think, or act like you.
In your novel, it doesn't appear that it's written for any particular color of reader. I mean, an African American teenager is going to identify with the characters as much as a white teenager or any color at all. But were you writing for a specific audience?
I'm writing for everyone. The way I structured the book, the hope was that everybody could find where they, like, their perspective.
Yeah, where they fit.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so there are parts of the book that are pure dialogue. There's no commentary. There are no dialogue tags. It's a name, a colon, and what the person says. And they take place, most of them take place in a classroom. So you're seeing all of these different perspectives, and you're hearing what these different teens are thinking about. And my hope is that in presenting things that way, readers are able to kind of figure out which teen they align with, and then they can kind of think about like where their thoughts line up with what everybody else is saying. So I really wrote it for my sons. I have a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old, and eventually, you know, 10 years from now, it's been 50 years since Dr. King was killed, and look where we are. In 10 years, there are still going to be people. Yeah, there are people who are going to look at my sons, and they're going to see a threat instead of a kid. And so I wanted them to be able to navigate this world that we live in. But the hope is that anybody who reads it can find something in there that they identify with.
And still a cracking good story.
Thank you.
Either way. Atlanta-based author Nick Stone. Dear Martin is her new novel. It launches today. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The event is 6:30 tonight at the National Center for Human and Civil Rights, and she will be at the Little Shop of Stories in Decatur next Tuesday evening. That's October 24th. Congratulations and thank you.
Thank you for having me.
It's on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. As anyone from Georgia knows, football is life. Whether you are a Falcons fan or maybe you're crazy about the Dogs, you know sports are a huge part of Southern and American culture, but you might not realize how much your obsession with your team makes you, you. Erin Tarver is a professor of philosophy at Emory University. She explores sports influence on lives and fandom in her new book. It's called The Eye in Team, Sports Fandom and the Reproduction of Identity. And she joins me now. Hi there, Erin.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's good to have you. And also with us is Vicki Michaelis, a professor of sports journalism at the University of Georgia. Hi, Vicki.
Hi, Celeste.
So, Erin, you have been a sports fan, sounds like, in your family, even going back generations.
That's right. I do not remember the very first time I went to a sporting event.
It was just too young.
Always part of life where I grew up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
And you guys obviously weren't a Dog fan, but
no, I'm sorry to say that.
Yes, but it sounds like it became almost a ritual in your life. Can you sort of describe the ritual of football, of that day of football, how that went?
Wow. So there's certainly the day of the game always involved a set of standard practices that we engage in. And so people who study sports fans make a big deal about the fact that this is ritualistic behavior. We put on our special clothing. We go to certain sacred space almost.
With other worshipers.
Exactly. there are certain chants and cheers that we engage in. And for individual sports fans, there's usually things that are specific to their family as well that they do. But for me, it wasn't just about the day of the game, but about the entire week. And I think most really devoted sports fans will tell you this, that, of course, going to the game is sort of the pinnacle of your sports fan practice, but that if you're a real fan, that every day is somehow involved in this. So there's a program that you watch on television, or you read the stats on what happened in practice the day before, or you have bought new decor for your office or your Christmas tree or your bedroom or whatever it is. There are a variety of ways in which sports makes its way into all of the minutiae of fans' lives.
Let's actually hear. This is Jake Mady. He grew up a Green Bay Packers fan, and he tells us about a few memories of being a lifelong sports fan.
Growing up in Green Bay, in Wisconsin, going to a lot of good Packer games, things like that with the family. Remember a lot of cool games, going back to the 96 playoff games with the Packers against the San Francisco 49ers, beating them. It was like 33 degrees in the rain in December going into the playoffs.
So, Vicky, you have been covering sports for a very long time, and that means covering these fans, right?
Not necessarily, but certainly observing the fans. I think I have a very different perspective than Aaron would, because as a sports journalist, you are asked to leave your fandom at home. So I don't necessarily, you know, write about sports fans, but I've certainly observed them along the way.
To what extent is a game's a reflection of the fan base, or a team a reflection of the fan base? Are the Yankees changed in character because of the character of their fans, for example?
I think very much so. They respond to their fans in a way that they adapt what their fans want them to be in many ways. And I think because it's all about the almighty dollar, the owners, the general managers all have to respond to what the fans want as well. And so therefore, the community's identity shapes the team's identity in many ways.
And Aaron, one of the things which is very interesting that you talk about in your book is the barrier to entry, right? That people are always trying to figure out if you're a real fan or not. Why is that?
That's an interesting question. I think that some theorists of popular culture talk about it this way, that things like sports fandom are a means of cultivating what they call popular cultural capital. So that means that your
street
ability.
Cred.
Yes, exactly. That's a great way of summarizing it. It loses its weight. It loses its significance if just everybody is allowed to be in the club, right? And so, if you could think about it analogously to somebody who is like a wine aficionado or something like that. If everybody knew how to do this particular thing, it wouldn't have the kind of social status that it has. And so sports, because it's accessible to everyone through television and radio and newspaper and all of this stuff, in order to retain that same kind of social significance, sports fans develop these ways of testing one another to determine whether they're real fans or not. And so for many men in particular, this involves knowledge acquisition and testing one another on their sports trivia knowledge, for example, and whether you can name, you know, who was it who was the starting quarterback in, you know, Super Bowl 25 or something like that, or who were all of the teams in the SEC, et cetera.
Right. So I wonder, Vicky, if that you've had that experience, especially as a woman covering sports. We know that that can be a sort of fraught field, right? So have you seen this being tested on your sports knowledge?
Pretty much every time I meet someone and tell them what I do, I get a test of something, and it's usually about their own team. So yes, I've seen that daily.
Do you give in? Do you tell them the right statistics to prove who you are?
It depends on the situation. If I feel like making a statement about, you know, whether that should be a test of whether I should be allowed into the you know, sports media, I probably resist it. But if it's a friendly social situation, I'll give in.
That is Vicki Michaelis. Do not test her on sports trivia because she has been covering it a long time. She's a sports journalism professor at UGA, and Erin Tarver teaches philosophy at Emory University. We're going to continue this conversation about sports and identity, plus values as well. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. We're talking with Erin Tarver, Emory philosophy professor and author of the new book, The I in Team, Sports Fandom and the Reproduction of Identity. And also with us is Vicki Michaelis, a professor of sports journalism at the University of Georgia. You know, Vicki, every time a team makes it into the playoffs, there are complaints about fair weather fans, right? I mean, people who just jumped on board because the team's winning. But I wonder, to a team, what's the best fan to have? Does it matter to them what kind of fan base they have?
The best fan to have is the fan that spends a lot of money whenever they're...
That's it? Doesn't matter how loyal and how much they love?
No, I really don't think so. I mean, it really is about the almighty dollar. And so the best fan is the one that buys the tickets and buys a lot of beer while they're at the game and buys the jerseys and buys their kids' jerseys and their babies' onesies. And I mean, obviously you want to have fans who do what Erin was talking about in terms of that initiation of their children and their entire family, because just like any other brand, if you can get them while they're young, you're going to have them for the rest of their lives.
Well, on that note, let's hear from Chad. He grew up watching football in Nashville, and he says football is his sport.
It's a great community. You have a loyal fan base, and the sport is awesome to watch. So, you know, you have families who are generational in terms of football and being a fan of one specific team. Nashville is relatively young still, but yeah, it does bring back good memories of growing up.
Which brings us back to you, Erin, because that loyalty can cut both ways, right? What if somebody is in a family that's a fan of a certain team and the kid goes to a different college, or the kid suddenly likes a different team, right? I mean, why do these loyalties spring up that sometimes disrupt families?
That's a great question. And I think that it can happen for a variety of reasons. What I will say is that it's... I would probably a minority of cases in which people do not maintain the loyalty of the fan base that they're raised with.
I thought you were going to say it's a minority of cases where people care about the team that much that they would.
No, I mean, what we tend to see is that if you ask people about, you know, how they became fans of the team that they're fans of, the vast majority of people, anyway, that I've encountered have a story about being raised by their family in a particular fan base, right? And so it might be because it's where they live, but it might be because it's where their parents are from, for example. But certainly there are cases in which individuals, say, disavow the loyalty of their families. And usually when they're doing that, it's indicative of some kind of larger statement that they're trying to make about their relationship to their family.
It sounds like you're talking about a religion. That sounds like you're leaving the family religion.
And I think that's a great analogy for what's going on in many of these cases. The role that sports fandom plays in the lives of sports fans is not unlike, for many fans, a religion. And so I think we see, when we see family rifts, say, about sports allegiance, this is really just indicative of the fact that sports fandom is, in the contemporary United States, one of the primary means that fans today use to tell themselves who they are.
It's really interesting. Erin is talking about sports in light of it being sort of like a religion or a worship. Vicki has been talking about it as pure capitalist corporate structure. Fascinating. Erin Tarver is philosophy professor at Emory University. Her new book is The I in Team, Sports Fandom and the Reproduction of Identity. And Vicki Michaelis is a sports journalism professor at UGA. Vicki and Erin, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This past Saturday, the Macon Symphony performed its last concert. After more than four decades, the orchestra announced this summer it would call it quits. The MSO cited lack of ticket sales as its primary reason for shutting down. We visited the Grand Opera House in Macon to talk to folks about the orchestra's last show. Aaron Odom was an intern with the Macon Symphony. Here's why he thinks the orchestra has been significant.
I think it's provided a really good way for downtown Macon to come together. You see folks that may not see each other at other points during the year, and they all get to come together and enjoy the art. Now that it's gone, I'm not sure what will replace it as far as bringing people together.
Karen Davis is a local educator. She says the MSO was the best resource in Macon for young players.
It's a mentorship for the next generation of musicians.
Virginia Underwood was there to support her father, the orchestra's principal oboist, for more than 30 years.
Well, I'm really impressed with how many people are here. You know, I keep seeing all these little charter buses pull up and drop people off. And, you know, I know the orchestra wanted to save it so bad. And I wish some of these people had been here earlier, but I'm glad that they're here now. Arts are just going away everywhere. They're not a priority anymore, and it's going to be a big loss for not just Macon, but people in the region.
We also caught up with the current artistic director and conductor, Jerry Steichen.
41 years is quite a journey, and it's also a journey that doesn't specifically end, because I'm very hopeful that the Macon Symphony is going to have a life beyond this. I know now is not a time when this community is able to support a full symphony orchestra. So maybe this is just not the time for Macon to have a symphony. I think it leaves a huge cultural hole in the community. But I think people will realize that, and I'm a firm believer in the mythical phoenix rising from the ashes. So I'm hopeful that this is not a permanent death, and that it's just a pause in the cultural life of Macon.
If you have thoughts or memories of the Macon Symphony, call and leave a message at 404-500-9457. We would love to hear them. You can also post on Facebook or Twitter. It's at OST Talk. Just ahead, a little more music. We'll add some new tunes to the Georgia playlist. It's on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Atlanta's Pride Parade drew thousands of people to Midtown over the weekend. GPB's Emily Curitan stopped by Piedmont Park to ask a few parade-goers what Pride events mean to them.
Greg, I'm from Atlanta. I love the parade. It's about being able to express yourself and to be true to yourself.
I'm Bill from Atlanta. The journey's been dark at times, but I'm thankful that it's hopeful.
And it has been. I felt as if I was on an island by myself. And then once I came out, I met these wonderful friends. And it's like, okay, I'm not by myself anymore. And it meant a lot.
Nanitha Mack, Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I support my son and my friends. I believe in love is love. I mean, it's me everything, long as I support my son.
Kevin, Fayetteville, North Carolina. I like to come to Pride just because of the unity. It's like a nice release, I guess, from where we're from, because we don't have this much support, so.
We're gonna end this parade on a good note.
My name is Paul. I'm from Dahlonega. I'd say it's about representation, that we matter, that our voices matter.
That piece was produced by GPB's Emily Curitan. To see pictures and videos of the Pride Parade, visit gpbnews.org. Now let's add a couple more tunes to our Georgia playlist. For this, we ask people to choose two songs they think best represent Georgia. Two simple rules: nominations have to be songs written or performed by a Georgian, and artists cannot nominate one of their own tunes. So today we feature the Atlanta band Omni. Bassist and vocalist Philip Frobos brings his picks for the Georgia playlist.
Hey, my name's Philip Frobos, and I play with a band called Omni from here in Atlanta, Georgia. My first pick for the Georgia playlist is Neon Lights by Love Tractor. It's a unlikely Kraftwerk cover from this Athens, Georgia band that often gets overlooked beyond B-52s and Pylon and REM, but it's really fantastic. It even surprised me when I was letting the record spin and it came on. So it's also just one of my favorite Kraftwerk songs too, so it's cool to hear it in a new wavy kind of way. It's just really bizarre and not a way that I would ever think of hearing this song, just because Kraftwerk is so, like, you know, so rigid and mechanic, whereas with this it's like kind of led by this constantly strumming acoustic guitar with like a really great lead, guitar lead, which is kind of like, you know, the Love Tractor thing. So I guess it's just like a really more unique and organic approach to a song that you probably would never imagine you'd hear this way. Kind of remind me a lot of modern bands right now that are kind of doing the same thing but probably have no idea who this band is. This sound is very specific to that Athens, Georgia time, which is nice. Just really clean, direct in, like, guitar, bass sounds, like nothing too fancy, just good Georgia post-punk. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is Waikiki by Current Rage. This band is really, really odd to me because I still can't really find anything about them online except for that Current Rage was a 80s post-punk new wave band from Atlanta, Georgia, that WRAS was their launching pad. There's no information about this band online. I picked it because I think it sounds really cool, and it just blows my mind that no one knows anything about this band. Even like your pillars of the music community around here, no one knows anything about this group. It's weird because I guess you don't hear a lot about Atlanta in that time. You hear more, it's all about Athens. And then if you do hear about Atlanta, it's like more about like hardcore and like, you know, like Neon Christ and all that kind of stuff. So I guess it is weird just because it's like, where did this fit in and where are these people and, you know, what happened? So
that was Philip Frobos of the Atlanta-based group Omni. They released their second record, Multitask, late last month.